from Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, Typhoon Matmo slams into China after pummeling Taiwan. Losing presidential candidate challenges Indonesian election results. Thai junta unveils temporary constitution. These stories and more in this Thursday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. A passenger plane has crashed in stormy weather on an island off the coast of Taiwan, leaving 47 people trapped in the wreckage and feared dead. Officials say the TransAsia Airways flight was trying to make its second landing attempt at Mongkong Airport when it went down in a nearby village. 11 people on board the flight were injured and sent to a local hospital. Hundreds of rescue workers, including military personnel, have been sent to the scene of the crash, where they could be seen working in the darkness using flashlights in their search for survivors. The crash came as Typhoon Matmo battered the area with heavy rains and strong winds. The plane took off after a nearly two-hour delay. Typhoon Matmo, meanwhile, made landfall in southern China, the second major storm to hit the country in a week. Winds gusted to 108 kilometers per hour as it swept over heavily populated Fujian province on Wednesday. Matmo passed over Taiwan earlier, where it brought torrential rains and strong winds. No serious damage was reported in Taiwan, although one farmer was killed and a tourist was reported missing after being swept to sea. Warnings of flash floods and landslides forced the closure of financial markets and most schools and government offices in Taiwan. The storm's arrival comes as the death toll in southern China from last week's typhoon increased to 56, with 20 more people missing. It was the strongest storm to hit the region in 40 years, also killing nearly 100 people in the Philippines and at least 11 in Vietnam. Former Army General Prabowo Subianto, who lost Indonesia's presidential election, has decided to challenge the result at the country's constitutional court. The move was announced by his spokesman Wednesday, a day after the Election Commission named his rival, former Jakarta Governor Joko Widodo, the winner of the July 9th vote. Subianto says Mr. Widodo's campaign took in large-scale vote buying and other fraud and accuses the Election Commission of not doing its duty in investigating the claims. The court challenge should take about a month to complete. Most analysts think it will prove unsuccessful. Edward Aspinall, an expert in Indonesian politics at the Australian National University, tells VOA it would be different for the court to overturn a six-point difference in the final results.
I think the chances are pretty much close to zero, and there would be no precedent in recent Indonesian electoral history of a constitutional court overturning a result to that extent. The allegations are also, from what we can see, don't seem to be particularly strong.
There have been no reports of violence, although thousands of police and military forces have been deployed in case of unrest. Aspinall says many groups affiliated with Prabowo Subianto have shown a willingness to use violence in the past, but he doubts whether that will be the case this time.
There's a coalition of organizations or people with a background and history of violence on that particular side, so you can never rule it out entirely. But my sense is that the further we go with the process, the chances of that sort of thing begin to diminish, partly because the coalition that coalesced around Prabowo during the election campaign is really starting to disintegrate.
Speaking Tuesday after the official results were released, President-elect Widodo, who won 53% of the vote, said now is the time for the country to come together after a hard-fought campaign. World leaders have already begun applauding Mr. Widodo and his victory. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry issued a statement congratulating Mr. Widodo and saying Washington looks forward to working with the new Indonesian president. The 53-year-old Mr. Widodo is also known by his nickname Jokowi and is seen by many as a reformer and a rare candidate without links to Indonesia's longtime dictator Suharto, who was ousted in 1998 and died 10 years later. Prabowo Subianto is a former son-in-law of Suharto and campaigned on a strong nationalist platform. Many were concerned that he would steer the country in an authoritarian direction since he's accused of rights abuses, including overseeing the arrest of democracy activists during his time as an army general. Thailand's military junta has unveiled an interim constitution that would allow the army to retain sweeping powers. And the army chief, who currently has total executive and legislative oversight, could become the kingdom's next prime minister. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from Bangkok.
Thailand's temporary charter is to legitimize the May 22nd coup and will effectively grant the junta supreme power over the country's political and judicial arenas. The military, which took power in a coup 2 months ago, is to handpick a 220-member legislature that will later select a prime minister and cabinet. Anyone who has held a political position in a current party will be excluded from the new group of lawmakers. An economic advisor to the military government, former Commerce Minister Narongchai Akransani, says this will likely lead to elections in October of next year.
The timeline is like this. Now we have the interim constitution, the names of the members of the NLA, National Legislative Assembly, would be announced most likely within 2 weeks, and government will be formed after that. And as General Prayut said, the government with military participation would be in place definitely in September.
On Tuesday, Thailand's revered 86-year-old king formally endorsed the interim charter in a ceremony with General Prayut Chan-o-cha, the army's chief. The ceremony, which took place in the coastal city Hua Hin, provides additional royal legitimacy to the coup by endorsing the new laws drawn up by the military. In the coming months, the junta's interim legislature is expected to choose a committee that will draw up a new constitution, which will then be submitted to the new reform committee for approval. In the meantime, there is strong speculation General Prayut will be selected as prime minister. A deputy junta leader and a legal advisor to the military government are not ruling that out, saying the choice will be up to the provisional parliament. The junta's reform plan largely meets the demands of the protesters in Bangkok, who occupied parts of the capital for months in a bid to push then-Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat from power. Protest leaders had called for an appointed committee to rule the country and implement far-reaching political reforms before holding new elections. Criticism of the new interim constitution in Thailand is understandably muted, since the military has authority to summon anyone making comments deemed to be political or that could cause unrest. The domestic media is operating under the harshest censorship seen here in decades. A member of Thai Students for Democracy, speaking to VOA by Skype, says his underground group will not surrender to the junta's anti-democratic decrees. Identifying himself as Rick Lee, the university student in Bangkok, characterizes the new charter as being imposed by a system of tyrants.
The latest military junta has still maintaining the value of constitutional and freedom, but right now our value of constitutions, check and balance, freedoms and liberty has gone. This is so ridiculous for them to do like this, because it means we are back to the situation like in Burma with the military rule. This is a huge step back for democratic development in this country.
Others expressing opposition, mostly through anonymous comments posted Wednesday on social media, lamented what they called a blow for democracy. The charter is also seen as a move by the junta to ensure political power will securely be in the hands of the conservative and royalist elite. The junta, formerly known as the National Council for Peace and Order, contends the interim charter will help solve the crisis and return the situation to normal, restore security, unity, and solve economic problems. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
The popularity of Japanese animation comes to Daybreak Asia in just a few minutes. Chinese police have arrested 5 employees of a Shanghai-based food supplier accused of selling expired meat to several fast food chains in China, including McDonald's and KFC. Shanghai police said Wednesday those arrested included the head of the Husi Food Company and its quality manager. China's Dragon TV on Sunday reported workers at Husi were mixing expired meat with fresh product, relabeling out-of-date goods, and even using meat that had fallen onto the floor. Restaurants including McDonald's, KFC, Burger King, and Starbucks have pulled products using Husi's meat. There have been no reports of widespread sickness. Some of the meat was also sold in Japan. The report has angered many Chinese who are especially sensitive toward food safety issues following repeated food safety scandals in recent years that have killed many people, including infants. The head of China's Communist Party, Xi Jinping, hailed the common socialist bond between his country and Cuba as he kicked off a state visit in Havana. President Xi was welcomed Tuesday by a military guard of honor at the Palace of the Revolution, where he met with Cuban President Raul Castro. Mr. Castro said his country's ties with China are at their best in history. Mr. Xi also praised the multifaceted relationship. Mr. Xi met briefly with aging revolutionary leader and former President Fidel Castro as he began his two-day visit. The trip is meant to expand political ties between the two allies and boost Chinese investment in Cuba. Attracted by the scholarships and the dream of an overseas education, students from Africa have turned to China as their lab to gain an edge in knowledge and experience. Their numbers are fast increasing into the tens of thousands annually. Officially, China awards scholarships for the skills development Africa most needs, but it's also a way to strengthen its soft power on the continent. Most of the students enjoy the experience, but some Africans also complain about the quality of education. Benno Mutchler brings us this report he researched with Yiting Sun on their recent trip to China.
On a chilly April day in Shanghai, Zambian student Violet Valya sat down in a cafe near Tongji University, one of the top schools in the country. It was lunchtime, and the cafeteria on campus offered a variety of Chinese dishes. But the college freshman said she cooks her homestyle food herself most of the time. She enrolled in Tongji University under a Chinese government scholarship in September 2013. She didn't know she would see so many people just like her.
Yes, I didn't expect so much Africans to be here. So when I came, I was shocked.
The wide-eyed 19-year-old Zambian was also amazed by China's development visible everywhere on the street.
Yeah, the infrastructure are so cool, they are roads, everything is just cool, I don't know. Our country really has tall buildings.
Like so many other African students on Chinese government scholarships, Violet Valya will spend her first year learning the language and then go to another university to study her major, medicine. All classes will be taught in Mandarin. African students who have been in China for a longer time say the language barrier can render the entire academic program just a process to receive a piece of paper.
Generally, I think the biggest challenge for an international student who comes to China to study English, an English course, is availability of lecturers who can actually speak English.
That's an African master student in Wuhan, central China, who studies in English. He wanted to remain anonymous because he didn't want to be heard criticizing Chinese education publicly. He said that his professors can't answer his questions because they don't speak English and he doesn't speak much Chinese either. His friend complained that it's too easy for Africans to get a pass.
Where I come from, you're really pushed by getting good grades. Yeah. You're not going to get a 90 by just showing up or just going to the exam. But here, when you come, they just give you 90s. For them, it's like you want the paper. And so they give you the paper and you go home.
Most African students, however, think positively of their experience in China. Juma Salum from Zanzibar, Tanzania, is pursuing a PhD in political science at Shanghai's International Studies University. Despite the challenging cold weather, he enjoys his studies very much. Like most African students in China, he wants to return after graduation to help his country.
I feel I have a burden to return to my country. And the most things to do, to work hard with the government, to support my government, to support my society, and to be a link between the Chinese people and Tanzania people and African people.
And Juma Salum is setting a trend that is growing exponentially. In 2012, China's Department of Foreign Assistance at the Ministry of Commerce said it hosted more than 27,000 students from Africa. By the end of 2013, there were over 35,000 African students in China. Benno Müchler with Yiting Sun for VOA News, Shanghai.
Afghan intelligence officials say Pakistan's military has made little headway in its offensive against the Haqqani network and other militant groups along the Afghan border. National Directorate for Security spokesman Habib Siddiqui told reporters in Kabul Wednesday that, unfortunately, so far the Pakistani operation has not inflicted a serious blow on any international terrorist organization. Pakistan began a ground operation against militants in the North Waziristan tribal district that borders Afghanistan in June. The tribal agency is a base for the al-Qaeda-linked Haqqani network that has carried out several deadly high-profile attacks against international coalition forces and Afghan officials in Afghanistan. Siddiqui said Wednesday that the Haqqani network has been immune from these operations and that the Afghan intelligence shows that many Haqqani leaders left North Waziristan prior to the start of Pakistan's military operation. In what is being seen as a breakthrough, officials from longtime rivals India and Pakistan will meet next month to move forward with the dialogue process. Pakistan's foreign ministry said Wednesday that Pakistani Foreign Secretary Aziz Ahmed Chaudhry spoke by phone with his Indian counterpart Sujatha Singh, with both secretaries agreeing to hold talks in Islamabad August 25th. The ministry said the dialogue process should be results-oriented and in keeping with the vision of the two prime ministers to improve and establish good neighborly relations. The president of the World Bank is praising the new Indian government's plan to revive economic growth and help lift nearly 270 million people out of poverty. On a three-day visit to India, Jim Song Kim met with Prime Minister Narendra Modi and Finance Minister Arun Jaitley and pledged $15 to $18 billion over the next 3 years in support of that country's proposed development initiatives. The World Bank president said Wednesday the Indian government is committed to introducing key reforms, including investing in infrastructure to create jobs and providing education and job training to the 8 million young people who enter India's workforce each year. Earlier this month, a new BJP-led government unveiled its roadmap to revive economic growth, which has dropped to less than 5% from nearly 10% growth a decade ago. Japanese animation is a remarkable example of how a modern, non-American culture has had an impact around the world. The many forms of anime have shown how cultural movements can gain huge global popularity when many people interested in an emerging industry combine their talents. Author Ian Condrey explores the phenomenon in his book, The Soul of Anime.
Collaborative creativity is one of the big ideas. And the hope is that we can see through the example of anime how committed, excited, passionate groups of people who may start as fans of something can build businesses and opportunities through that passion and through the collective action of working with peers. Because that's what animation tells us, is that the success of Japanese animation came out of a kind of bottom-up excitement. And even so, it became a global industry and a global culture that offers excitement and mystery for generations to come.
Anime has been around for a long time. What is the fascination with it around the world?
What I think it shows is that when we're looking for how new businesses and new kinds of expression emerge, that we have to look at the communities that invent them. You know, right now, I know a lot of young people are worried about where are the jobs of the future going to come from? What are ways we can imagine new kinds of economies happening? And animation is a fascinating example because 100 years ago, there was no such thing as animation. And that Japan has been such a success shows one of the paths how that new kind of business, new kind of economy can happen.
From an anthropological standpoint, you have a lot to really dig into as far as the Japanese culture of animation.
You're not kidding. It's amazing the variety of stories that are out there. You know, the ways that you look at Japanese animation and there's questions of gender and sexuality and confusion about these spaces. There's also all of this exploration of bravery and courage, and even the ways technology and war and the environment are interrelated. I mean, that's what makes animation such a fascinating world. It's endless, and you can explore in all these different dimensions, from great shows like Death Note or Bleach or Naruto or slice of life shows that give us a sense of what the everyday world of being a teenager is like. It's a huge universe of culture and expression that it's not surprising to me that so many people are attracted to it.
What makes anime so different from the kinds of animation that we're used to here in the United States?
Animation in Japan was in some ways inspired by Disney, and comic books in Japan were also inspired by early comic book experiments in the U.S. there's always been a tight connection between Japan and the U.S. in terms of their animation businesses. In the 70s, American animation companies were outsourcing their work to Japan. It was part of the thing that helped grow Japanese animation as well. But why Japanese animation was able to, in some ways, supersede American animation, especially in the global television market, is partly that Japanese animators learned to make their animation more cheaply, and they would give it away. The first season you get free. If your fans like it, then we'll talk about the second season and work out a deal. And so it's a remarkable example of bootstrapping a media economy thanks to the excitement of fans around the world. And because that excitement built and that access built around Japanese animation, it becomes locked in as a style, as something people appreciate and want to keep going forward with. Pixar and Disney have taken certain steps towards the Hollywood blockbuster market, and they're hugely successful. And Japanese animation has carved out a somewhat different space, in some ways a wider range of material that reaches a somewhat different and yet equally dynamic and excited audience.
Interestingly, too, it has created a bit of a fantasy world that many have just lost themselves in. It has become a reality of sorts for many people.
Animation makes us question how real reality is. If what makes something real is our ability to feel something and to respond and to have a kind of communicative human energy come out of that relationship, it's kind of funny, but it's true that sometimes that happens more in a fantasy world, in a two-dimensional world, than one might have in the mundane day-to-day life. And maybe that says something about where we are as a society and living in the era we're living in.
The technology has made it easier for people to get into animation and work with it and distribute it. I'm sure that has had quite an impact in the growth of the industry, especially in the last 20 years or so.
Exactly. And so you say, why was Japan the source of so much of the world's animation and comic books? And it's a really interesting historical story. In the U.S., in the 1940s and early 50s, there was an outcry against violence and sexy comic books that were corrupting children of the day. The comic book industry publishers took a stand that said comics have to be uplifting and good for the children of America. And it made our comics in the U.S. something just for children. In Japan, the same kind of outcry came out. But in the end, the comic book publishing industry had a more open view. And so grown-ups and older people and teenagers become totally enchanted by the weekly comic books that then became the basis for this huge animation culture.
Are there any personal favorites that you have that you might like to share?
There are so many that I like. I mean, right now, I've been fascinated by Attack on Titan. Space Dandy is kind of inappropriate, but also interesting. And then I like a classic gag anime like Sayonara Zetsubo Sensei, which means goodbye, Mr. Despair.
Where do you see the future of anime going from this point? Is it going to continue to expand and find new horizons?
Absolutely. I think animation has proved that there are ways to make a sustainable creative business, even as the package industry of DVDs and CDs is disappearing. Because ultimately, economies are built on the excitement and the social energy of the audience and the fans who care. And as long as that's there, I believe there will be a business in the future for anime and, in fact, all kinds of art forms today.
Ian Condrey, author of The Soul of Anime, Collaborative Creativity, and Japan's Media Success Story. It's published by Duke University. Interestingly, Mr. Condrey's appearance with us comes on the 75th anniversary of Batman, starting in comic books. We have our own Caped Crusader of the latest world news, none other than Steve Norman, who will be joining us next with International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for stopping by and sharing some time with us on Daybreak Asia.